I am Charlotte Casaraghi, and in partnership with the House of Chanel, I present to you the Les Rencontres podcast. As part of the Rendez-vous littéraire at Rue Cambon, this podcast spotlights the birth of a female writer. You can listen to the various episodes and their authors on your preferred streaming platforms.
Happy Saturday. It is March 23rd, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
We are two of your airmail editors here to say congratulations. It's Saturday. You made it. Yes, it was a week. Donald Trump is still in the presidential race. Food security experts are warning that a famine is imminent in Gaza. Meanwhile, as Hong Kong is preparing to welcome visitors from all over the world to Art Basel, its semi-autonomy has been threatened yet again with all of these new security laws that they have passed at Beijing's behest, aimed at suppressing dissent. Anyway, that being said, Michael, airmail is here. We are the antidote to all of that, or at least to some of that. And we have a great episode of Morning Meeting here to talk about some things that have not been as discussed in the news.
Exactly. We've got Louis Czeslaw, who's going to join us from New York with his report on the turmoil that has consumed one of the art world's most influential publications, Art Forum. And then Elena Claverino, who is a senior editor here at Airmail, will join us with her fascinating and funny report on how the English language is conquering the native languages of Europe. Don't believe me? Well, it's so pervasive that Germans can't help but call this new problem Ein Shitstorm. And finally, James Kirchick will be here joining us from Washington to discuss the new book on gender by the controversial writer Judith Butler. Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, we're journalists. Let's start with the media. Louis Czeslaw is here to walk us through an extraordinary moment in the life of Art Forum magazine. Louis is a former editor with New York Magazine and a writer based in London. Welcome, Louis.
Thank you. Hi.
So back in October, we heard a lot of reporting about Art Forum magazine and the open letter that the magazine published condemning Israel at the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Take us back to what happened.
Yeah, of course. So the first thing to know really is that for the last 6 years, Art Forum has had one editor-in-chief, David Velasco. And he'd been there since 2005, actually, 18 years total. And as well as being a kind of passionate editor and art world fixture, Velasco was also known for not shying away from big political swings at times. So in October, he's thinking about how his magazine should respond to the Israel-Hamas war. Should he commission an essay? Should he write something himself? And then this open letter comes his way that's been signed by 8,000 people in the art world, among them a ton of people who he sees as really at the core of Art Forum's community, people like Nan Goldin, Barbara Kruger. And this letter is calling for a ceasefire. It's calling for urgent aid to Gaza. But critically, it doesn't mention the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th at all. And when he publishes and signs the letter himself, that omission sets off this huge storm. And irate collectors call artists who've signed it, demanding that they retract their signatures. They call museums that are exhibiting these artists' work and they ask the museums to take the work down. And a bunch of advertisers also begin plans to pull funding from the magazine. And so it reaches a real fever pitch. And that gets to the magazine's owner, Jay Penske, who calls a meeting with Velasco and ultimately fires him. And just to kind of close the recap, this starts a whole new drama. Hundreds of people who love Velasco sign a letter boycotting Art Forum, including many of its longtime contributors. And a number of editors also quit in support of Velasco. And so by the end of October, Art Forum is without an editor and all of its community have abandoned it, so to speak.
I mean, what's interesting is it's not as though Art Forum, it wasn't the first time it took a stance that was controversial or confrontational. You note specifically Nan Goldin wrote her piece attacking the Sackler family that sort of basically changed how museums and institutions sort of took money from that family, right? So they did have this position and this sort of advocacy did not come out of anywhere, right?
No, completely. Velasco has always taken up positions. He also famously was part of a group that had Warren Kanders ultimately resigned from the board of the Whitney Museum. And the thing that really changed here is that the magazine was independent at the time that those articles came out. And in 2022, it was acquired by Penske Media Corporation, who also own Variety, Billboard. And so suddenly this kind of independent publication becomes part of a much larger corporation. And even though Velasco says that he never had any direct communication from Penske about whether or not he should take a political opinion in the magazine, Penske Media ultimately say when they fire him that he kind of violated editorial protocol taking such a position this time.
You know this from Velasco because you sat down with him for your story this week and got sort of, he had been silent until this time about what all had happened. A new editor-in-chief has now finally been named. When you asked Velasco what happened that day or in the days after that letter was published, you detail that he was basically called to meeting with Penske, right? And what happened there and then how did it all play out?
Right. So he says the first that he heard from Penske was actually just a day after the open letter came out. And it was kind of a missive from Penske. They just kind of said, we need to talk, kind of this looming meeting. And ultimately they met, I believe it was the following week, 6 or 7 days later. And he wasn't fired in this meeting. There's kind of some dispute over what happened in the meeting itself, but ultimately it seems like he was asked to do some kind of statement or retraction or walk back a mea culpa, as Velasco said himself. And he wasn't comfortable walking back the letter. He stood behind it. He still to this day says he has no regrets about it. And that meeting didn't go well. And within a few hours, he lost access to his email and his firing was communicated to him. And by that night, he was out of a job. And he says, without severance, without health insurance. So a really major day in his time at the Mex.
Louis, what has happened to him since he lost his job?
Yeah, he was actually very honest with me about how the last few months have been for him. He's adjusting really to a new financial reality. I mean, he says he was living paycheck to paycheck even before this happened, given how expensive New York is and journalism salaries, as we know that they can be. But he's now had to go a step further. He's had to sublet his apartment. He is crashing at friends' places. He told me that he grew up very working class and that he doesn't have anything to fall back on. And that's been made worse by the fact that he was fired without severance and has had to look into health insurance now that he doesn't have it through his job. And so he's really adjusting to not having much money at the moment. And so he's looking for a new job. He's open to a new job, but he's also very nervous and cautious about what that might be. But crucially, he says he has no regrets. But also, I think the last thing I'll add too is that he's not the only one who left the magazine and is now struggling. I mean, Kate Sutton is an editor who quit with him. She was the International Reviews editor. And she's not just a former editor, she's also a single mother who told me she started to, quote, hit the panic button financially recently. So these people, they don't regret what they did and they wouldn't change it. There's no disputing the fact that they need to pay their rent, they need to eat, and that's not so easy in a media landscape where jobs are disappearing, not really growing.
Louis, this letter was signed by 8,000 people, and many of them have fairly high profiles. Was it only the people on staff at Art Forum that seemed to have the most severe repercussions, or what was the blowback for everyone else?
Yes, so it wasn't just the Art Forum staffers that had to deal with blowback from this. Many of the artists who signed the piece felt a lot of pressure very quickly. Several art collectors tried to shut down an exhibition of work in Ohio by an artist who had signed the letter, the ongoing exhibition. Nicole Eisenman, who's a Guggenheim fellow and has been in many Whitney Biennials, said that she heard from many collectors of her work telling her that she shouldn't have signed it. And actually, a number of artists who had signed the letter, including Peter Doig, Joan Jonas, they ended up retracting their names from the letter. They asked Velasco to take their names down from the piece in the following days.
And Louis, has Jay Penske had any comment since this?
He has not. We reached out to him for comment for this story and he declined to. But interestingly, Art Forum, which kind of stayed dark for a number of months, I mean, not stayed dark, they kept publishing, but they didn't by any means look for media attention. They did just last week announce a new editor-in-chief to replace Velasco. That is a woman called Tina Rivers Ryan, who until recently was the curator of the Buffalo AKG Art Museum. And they've also hired a few new editors. So even though Jay Penske wouldn't speak to me for the story, they do seem to be trying to rebuild the magazine and to kind of hope that even as this boycott continues, I spoke to many artists and members of the art community who say they still will not contribute to the magazine. They seem to be hoping, Penske's team, that this will eventually blow over somehow.
When you spoke to Velasco, is he still, he's expressed that he still supports what he said, but where does he see his life and career going forward? How does he feel about making this type of moral stance 5 months later?
Yeah, it's a good question. The sense I got from talking to him was really of a man who's just in a deeply reflective pause moment. I mean, I think when you're in that art world, when you're in a position like he was, life can be a whirlwind. You're editing, you are at parties and openings. And I get the sense that he still is kind of taking stock of what he described as just an insane, insane period for him. So in terms of his next professional steps, I think he's waiting and hoping that something meaningful might come his way. But the sense I got from talking to him really was just someone who was trying to catch his breath after a very, very intense period.
Louis, what do you think this story is reflecting about what's really going on in the media world right now? Like, why is the story about so much more than just Art Forum?
It's a big question. I think this story reflects the delicacy of how this conflict is playing out in creative and media companies in the United States. I mean, Art Forum is not the only magazine or even creative institution that is kind of drawing lines in real time about how to respond to staff involvement in these matters. Condé Nast has been reminding staff of its social media policies. Hearst is warning employees not to even like tweets that could show how they feel about this thing. Additionally, in Hollywood and the West Coast, agents have lost their job for speaking up. So I think it just shows that even as public opinion moves along, there's still an open question about how every single company is delineating how to treat employees who choose to take a stand on this issue.
Well, it's a really interesting story, Louis, and you told it exceptionally well. Thank you so much for making us aware of what the stakes are in these kinds of situations and for sharing it with us.
Thank you both for your time. Thank you.
Michael, journalism, a tough gig even in the best of times. Don't know why we do it, except it's the only thing that we know how to do, and we also love it.
Yeah, and someone who loves it also is Jamie Kirchick, who's got a review this week of a new book by Judith Butler, who, as he calls her, is the queen of the quad. For those of you who don't know Judith Butler, she is the author of a new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? And Jamie has reviewed it in this week's issue of Airmail and is here to tell us all about it.
Jamie is a writer at large at Airmail and the author of Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. He also did a great piece for us on Armie Hammer that if you have not read, it's worth going back and checking out. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello.
So, Jamie, your review of Judith Butler's new book is really wonderful to read. So, first of all, just an introductory level, who is Judith Butler?
Judith Butler is a professor of comparative literature, interestingly enough, at the University of California at Berkeley. But she's really known as a critical theorist, heavily influenced by the French critical theorists of the 60s and 70s, mostly Michel Foucault. And her big claim to fame is a book she published in 1990 called Gender Trouble. And what she's so famous for is this notion of gender being a performance, right? That this concept of gender is not what you're born with, but how gender is performed, how one acts, that there are masculine ways of behavior, feminine ways of behavior. This is not actually a very profound insight. As I note in the piece, Plato even talked about this many, many, many years ago, but she really sort of popularized it and sort of distinguishing the notion of gender from sex. But even in that book, she also came out basically saying that sex too was also something of a social construction, right? Which is that what's between your legs also doesn't really matter in the same way that what's between your ears doesn't really matter in terms of what you consider yourself to be. And all of this is really a way of saying, in my view, that she really doesn't believe in the concept of objective truth, like a lot of these critical theorists, that truth is relative, that truth is created by the situations that we're in. It's created by the structures of power that oppress us. And that's what brings us to her latest book.
As you cite in your piece, Jamie, you mentioned a quote from Andrew Sullivan, as he said a few years ago, that, quote, we all live on campus now. And if that's the case, then Judith Butler, as you write, is the queen of the quad. How do these conversations around campus inform her worldview and the premise behind her new book, Who's Afraid of Gender?
Well, it seems that these ideas might have been relegated to the campus until quite recently, right? So the introduction of pronouns in people's Twitter bios and email signatures, that's a very new development. I think we can sort of trace that to the influence of Judith Butler. The explosion of young people identifying as transgender, as opposed to transsexual, which is a term that we don't use anymore. But that was the term that was used for people who actually went through sex changes, right? To actually change their sex by taking hormones or undergoing surgeries and whatnot. This new concept of transgender came about, which can really change with the day. Someone can say they're one gender one day and another gender the next. That's an idea that originates with Butler, or at least was popularized by her, and is certainly the focus of this book, Who's Afraid of Gender, which is really a broadside on any and all people who oppose or are even just skeptical of these ideas. And it's sloppily written in the sense that she conflates all opposition, right? So people on the far right, like, say, Viktor Orban, are grouped in with feminists who have concerns about, say, biological men competing in women's sports. But to Butler, they're all the same, right?
Jamie, why do you think this is a dangerous way of looking at this issue?
Well, just a couple days ago, the British government banned the provision of puberty blockers to minors. This is after years of debate about this. And the reason they did so is because the research is not sound. And the long-term consequences of putting young people who are gender dysphoric, who might be confused about their gender, the long-term consequences of putting them on these drugs, on these hormones, of undergoing irreversible medical procedures, these are very grave and profound consequences to these things. And the British government has been following several other European governments, all of which, by the way, have socialized medicine. These are not extreme right-wing governments we're talking about. They've all drastically dialed back the treatment regimes and the transitioning medical procedures that Judith Butler euphemistically describes as trans healthcare. So that's what's happening in Europe. And Judith Butler gives no regard to this. She doesn't grapple with the science. She doesn't engage in dialogue with the people who disagree with the provisioning of these medical treatments. And there's no grappling with that in this book. Everyone who disagrees with her is a fascist or a bigot. There's no room for nuance here. There's no legitimate or honest disagreement with the notion, say, that people who have penises should not be allowed into a rape shelter. She has a whole discourse here, making, rationalizing the placement of natal men, okay, transgender women. These are people who have male anatomy, allowing those people into rape shelters and women's prisons. This does not seem like a very feminist argument to me.
And Jamie, how are Butler's ideas embraced or considered by other thinkers and intellectuals in the trans community?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's actually a lot more intellectual diversity within the trans community than you would think just by reading the media, which seems to present a very narrow perspective. I mean, trans people I know really disagree with a lot of the ideas pushed by Butler. They just want what most people want, which is to be treated with respect and dignity and to be treated equally. And they can understand that it is not fair for someone like Leah Thomas, who was a male swimmer, pretty middling male swimmer for the University of Pennsylvania team, ranked something like 450th in the country, who then, after transitioning, became the number one champion female swimmer in the country. They understand that that's not fair and that opposing something like that does not make one bigoted against trans people. They understand that there's a balance to be struck between the rights that transgender people should have as American citizens and the questions surrounding fairness or the questions surrounding safety in intimate female-only spaces, that there are reasonable precautions that might need to be taken with these things. So I don't think that Judith Butler's ideas are necessarily that popular with the vast majority of trans people. She's popular, that upper slice of academics, right, and people in the media who like the idea. They just like to provoke. So much about journalism and the media and academia today, it's all, the French have an expression, épater le bourgeois, to scandalize the bourgeoisie. And that is what Judith Butler and her acolytes have dedicated their careers to for the past 40 years. And it's unfortunately having real serious political repercussions, right? That you are seeing a backlash to this.
So, Jamie, it's interesting though, as you write, like she used to be a campus phenomenon now, and now she's become much more talked about in terms of popular culture. Where do you see this all going?
Like I said, it's inspiring a backlash. And so the question is up to the leaders of these institutions, right? Our universities, our nonprofits, our Hollywood and cultural communities. And I would just hope that this disconnect would really force the people in positions of responsibilities at these institutions to do a better job of putting out research and ideas that are actually realistic.
Fascinating stuff, Jamie. Thank you so much, not only for your thoughtful review of the book, but also for speaking about it here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's turn now to a fascinating report from Elena Claverino that reveals how the languages of Europe, from Italian to French to German, find themselves being slowly conquered by an invasion of English words and phrases. The result has leaders and linguists fearful for the future. Elena is a senior editor here at Airmail. Welcome, Elena.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So you're a woman of the world. You sort of split your time between New York and Milan and other places around the globe. But in your column this week, you've identified a rather sort of, you're a multilingual person, but something sort of distressing in Milan. And can you tell us about the invasion of English back there?
Yeah, so I was talking to a friend and he was saying the other day, he was like, oh, let's go for drinks to this bar called Wineria. I mean, it was kind of a distortion of an English word with a part of an Italian word mashed on the end. And then I started noticing how many of those we use, especially for things regarding technology. Like, there isn't really an Italian word for download or for browser and stuff like that. But also in general, in the workplace, especially, appropriated a lot of English words or English sounding words that sometimes don't even work in English.
I love your story about how at the beginning you were on your way to a business meeting and you sort of like get this series of English language words dropped into where to park your car. And can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So basically in the email that they wrote me, they said the meeting had been schedulato, which is a mix between schedule, the Italian tacked onto the end. We're going to be meeting for a briefing to discuss hotspots. And in Italian, oddly enough, hotspots, it's not anything to do with Wi-Fi. It's basically migrant centers in the south where migrants who come in from Africa are welcomed into the country and brought in. And anyway, so, and then they told me to park my car into the office box, which a box is a garage in Italian or Italish.
When you said schedulato, I thought of a chakarato, which is another whole mashup, but that's something for to do after work. As you note in your column this week, it's not just Italian that's been sort of under siege by English and sort of the creeping English influence. You also noticed German and French as well. And can you give us what you've seen there or heard there, I should say?
So when I noticed this in Italian, I started looking into it in other languages. And there had been some like stories in the past of different linguists and like purists and stuff like that complaining that English was invading French and German too. And like with Italian, there are some like appropriated English terms that are used in French that are not used in English, like baby foot for soccer or brushing, which is a hair blowout. And the same goes for German. So I thought it was pretty interesting how English is infiltrating these languages, sometimes also insidiously in the grammar. For example, like in German, when you're using the possessive form and saying Karl's restaurant or Karl's pub, you don't use an apostrophe between the Karl and the S. And a lot of Germans have actually started doing that because of English.
Ellen, how many languages do you speak?
Three.
And those would be?
Spanish, Italian, and English. No French, unfortunately.
Well, my favorite example that you use here is the German one, which is, I can't even pronounce the word for a wave of anger. Can you pronounce that word and tell us a story about that?
It's Empörungswelle. Sorry, excuse my... Basically, Germans use very, very long words that are kind of more like phrases than words. It's something that's like a particular characteristic of German, which is kind of fun. And words like that, which I won't repeat for your sake, are being replaced with English words. So instead of that word, which means a wave of anger, they'll say Ein Shitstorm, for example.
Yeah, which is like you've lost the whole poetry of German that we loved, which is Gotterdammerung and Schadenfreude. And we've adopted those into the English language. And yet, like, they seem more, guys, Ein Shitstorm is like too base. We had such great words with phrases with that, but it's a new generation who wants that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is a shame. And I noticed it with Italian too. I mean, it's my friend. It's like, there is, for example, when you're talking about something that happened many years in the past, or I mean, 2-3 years in the past, you'll use a remote form of the past tense. And it's, I mean, it sounds very beautiful when spoken. And a lot of people are kind of abandoning that and just using the simple past tense because, I mean, that's kind of what you do in English. It's easier. So, I mean, it's a bit of a shame.
You're also, Ein Shitstorm is driving out phrases, not just in German, but in Italian, tremabondo, which is for trembling, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Some very beautiful words that seem to be like Dante would be rolling in his grave now.
Exactly. Abbindolare, we need that one. Zufolare.
Abbindolare is to be taken for a ride, right?
Exactly. And zufolare is to whistle.
Which is so mellifluous. It sounds exactly like what it is. It's beautiful, right?
It is very beautiful. I mean, there has always been words that fall out of use, new words that go into use. I think the difference is just the speed at which the world is changing and how slow linguists are to adapt, which is kind of concerning.
The politicians, as you report, current as well as past. I love the example you have about where Mussolini was 80 years ago and where Giorgia Meloni is now, both of them trying to protect the Italian language, and Mussolini's example that led to Italianization of English names and things.
Yeah, so I mean, Mussolini was kind of a pioneer in this aspect. In 1929, he banned all foreign words and he kind of mended some Italian replacements that were kind of funny. I mean, Fred Astaire was called Federico Astorio. There were others too. There was a bar became Qui si beve, which means here we drink. Washington, D.C. became Vosintone. So anyway, there are all these kind of funny alternatives, and most of them were abandoned. Tramezzino for sandwich was kept. But yeah, historically, these measures haven't worked.
But now Maloney is, she's trying to do her own version of sort of instituting fines, right?
Yeah. So in April, I think it was 2022, she said that anyone who uses English, like official documents, would be fined. I think it was between like 100,000 euro or 5,000 to 100,000 euro. The law is awaiting parliamentary debate, so it's unclear whether it's going to be passed or not. But these things don't always work. French, the president of the Académie Française, which is this institution that protects Jean Romain, basically said that often the substitute terms are kind of ridiculous and no one uses them. So it's hard.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be ein shitstorm debate in the Italian parliament over it. It's sad that some of these phrases are moving out of and being substituted for English, which is just this dog's breakfast of language. And that's its sort of beauty that it sort of adapts and grabs everything from around the world. But you know, I was thinking too, just German, they've replaced Kassenschlager, right? Which is box office hit just for blockbuster, which is, I'd rather have a Kassenschlager. Oppenheimer should be a Kassenschlager. You mentioned linguists in your column this week. How does this play out? Are people concerned that Italian and German could basically be watered down to the point of extinction? Or what do they think could happen here?
There's one linguist, one prominent Italian linguist called Claudio Marazzini, who thinks that Italian will be extinct by 2300, which is a terrifying prospect. I don't know if I believe him, but I really do see a huge difference between how my friends speak versus how our grandmothers used to speak. It's a lot less eloquent. It's full of grammatical error often. The vocabulary is a lot smaller. So, I mean, it could be true.
Makes me a little wistful. Do you think that technology has a part to play in it as well? I mean, texting and just the way language sort of gets chopped down there too for your generation?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the formalities that in English don't exist as much have been done away with through texting and also emailing. And I mean, for the sake of time.
Well, Eleanor, I've enjoyed speaking with you today. And it's just the kind of story thing I love here at Airmail, because it just sort of touches on how the world's evolving and what we're gaining and what we might be losing and how we live. But I guess one positive is maybe it means if you're American and you're going to get a little better chance of being understood these days without having speaking the native language.
Exactly. I mean, actually, it might be even more confusing. They'll tell you the car's in the box.
And schedulato, near shakarato.
Exactly.
Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today and for this wonderful, wonderful column this week.
Thank you so much, Michael. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. Airmail's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, Airmail Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, the weekend is here. Thank goodness. We all need it. Do you have anything at all you can recommend to us?
I do. I have two things quickly. As you know, Ashley, I was in Paris recently, and I just want to remind everyone, there is a show there, the Rothko Show in Paris. And it's, if you've heard about this show, it is everything that claims to be monumental, staggering, and I would even say emotion-inducing. It almost moved me to tears at points. And I would say, if you are near Paris, if you can afford to fly to Paris, go see this show before it closes in a couple of weeks. Lots of shows are billed as these once-in-a-lifetime experiences. This truly is. I mean, when they brought together every work of his, including the Seeger murals and the entire Tate Gallery paintings, you just have to see it to believe it. It's at there now. And actually, I would say you should get on the channel, go over there. It's spectacular. So I can't recommend it enough.
Paris is always a good idea, Michael.
Paris is always a good idea. And second of all, I have a book for you. I know many of us, this 2024 is a year we'd sooner skip through. And if you're looking for a riveting thriller set in the near future, 2054, that's the title of the book, is perfect for you. It's set in the future after a war between China and the U.S. has toppled America's old political order and allowed a new party and president to take power. But chaos breaks out when the president dies, and then this cover-up comes along that follows and the country descends into a civil war. I know, doesn't seem like it's too far in the future, but that's just the beginning in this book. It's smartly co-written by Elliot Ackerman, who's an Airmail contributor and has been nominated for the National Book Award, and Admiral James Stavridis, who is the former Supreme Commander of NATO. So it knows the military part quite well. And it's a taut, chilling, provocative page-turner. It's got a little bit Michael Crichton, a little bit Tom Clancy, and it's all very provocative. Most of all, it might just make you think that these days could very well be the good old days. And you, my dear?
Well, I saw a play last night. We went to go see Harry Clark in the West End. Did you see this when it was on Broadway in New York?
I didn't. Please tell me about it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So it's written by David Kale, who is a well-known English-American playwright. He also wrote that TV show Russian Doll, which you might have seen. This is a one-man show and it stars Billy Crudup. Obviously, he's in one of my favorite movies, Almost Famous. And then he was in The Morning Show. I think he was the best thing about The Morning Show, which, as you know, I was completely immersed in this winter. He's incredible in this play. I mean, I think the entire reason for this play to exist is just to show what a great actor Billy Crudup is, because he plays so many different characters. I mean, it's really about one guy who has multiple personalities, but he plays all of the characters that he interacts with. And it's unbelievable how he uses facial expression and his accent and his body language to completely transform not only the character, but also his physical appearance. I mean, he looks, depending on which character he's playing, he just looks like a completely different guy. It was one of the strangest things I've ever seen on stage, but it was 80 minutes long. He played 19 characters. It was surely the most exhausting thing that has ever happened on a London stage, but a really well done, fascinating play about a guy in New York who's a bit of a grifter, Michael, subject matter you and I are going to love. But hats off to Billy Crudup. This guy is next level. The play is only going to be in the West End until May 11th, so it's a short amount of time. But if you are a London theater fan, a theater fan, I highly recommend it. Harry Clark, written by David Kale at the Ambassador's Theater, starring Billy Crudup. All right, well, we wish you all the most wonderful weekend. Hopefully we all have some sunshine and some flowers wherever we're living. Michael, will you please read us out?
Absolutely. We'd also like to thank our sponsor, Chanel. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. And you can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We'll be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.